Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Sachin Jain, President and CEO of CareMore, an innovative coordinated care delivery model for high-use patients in Medicare and Medicaid, using team-based interventions, ride services, a program to target loneliness and inactivity to yield better outcomes and a better quality of life for patients. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. And you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please feel free to leave a review there. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Sachin Jain on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sachin Jain, President and CEO of CareMore Health, an integrated healthcare system focused in on improving care coordination with high-risk Medicare and Medicaid patients. Previously, Dr. Jain was CareMore's Chief Medical Officer and Chief Operating Officer. He also served as Chief Medical and Information Officer at the pharmaceutical company Merck. He was first Deputy Director for Policy and Programs at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation under President Obama and CMS Administrator Don Berwick. He was just named to Modern Healthcare's 50 Most Influential Physician Executives. He earned his BA, MBA, and medical degree from Harvard and completed his residency at Brigham and Women's in Boston. Dr. Jain, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, and as a physician with a real focus on care transformation, it seems like you've landed in the perfect spot at CareMore, which is an integrated health plan and delivery system focused specifically on care coordination for the dual eligibles, Medicare and Medicaid patients, and designed to target high-risk, chronically ill patients through focused care coordination. And you've been getting lots of national attention for significantly reducing hospitalization and poor health outcomes with this model. I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about your unique approach and why it's been so effective.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I would say the great thing about CareMore is that it's not so much a model. It's actually multiple models. But more importantly, it's an approach. I think it's a philosophy of care. The idea that we need to better manage chronic disease, we need to understand the social determinants of health, and really manage the disconnection that patients experience when they receive care across the care continuum. And we, are fundamentally organized around the problems that patients experience and work to try to solve those problems. We have multiple different operating models, but what I would say is one common culture, one common philosophy, one common approach to actually addressing the needs of the patients that we serve.
Dr. Jain, I can't believe it's been 25 years since your company was founded. And it was partly because of this goal that the company had, which was to redesign how the healthcare system treats the most vulnerable and the highest risk patients, who are often the elderly. You've laid out this three-pronged approach that's been developed. You've got the CareMore Care Center, the CareMore Chronic Care Management Programs, and then you've got something called the CareMore Extensivist. Talk with us about how these three entities are designed around the patient experience.
So, let's start with the care centers. I mean, I think the care centers take all the things that you'd love to have in a primary care office, but that most primary care offices are subscale to deliver. And so we have chronic disease management programs. We have, for all the most common chronic diseases of the senior population, we have integrated behavioral health to make sure that we're addressing the behavioral health needs of the patients that we serve. We have dietitians to help with counseling. We have exercise programs that are focused on the senior population. What all of that amounts to is really risk stratification of patients and then targeted and focused interventions to keep our patients healthy when they could otherwise be getting sick. The second piece of it, the extensivists are really about taking care of the patients when they're in the hospital, but then also taking care of them in post-discharge follow-up as well as in a post-discharge clinic. And ordinarily, that would be three different care teams that are actually taking care of the patients. We have one team taking care of the patient across all of those sites, and what it does is it creates a higher level of coordination across all of that care. And then the third piece is really the case management infrastructure, and that that really is the glue across the system. And the truth is that, you know, our system's not perfect. And so it's our case management that actually keeps it all together and, you know, connects all the different pieces for our patients. So that's in addition to the patient's primary care provider. So there's this whole extra infrastructure that wraps around the traditional healthcare system that actually makes it work for the patients. And what we see is that we have fewer hospital admissions, shorter lengths of stay, more satisfied, more loyal patients, more patients who end their life in hospice, and delayed progression or slowed progression of chronic disease.
Well, and I think your whole model, that this approach is about a philosophy of care, and, you know, particularly how patient noncompliance is not about them. Oftentimes it's about a not perfect system. And the organization was one of the first systems in the country to provide ride services for patients to keep appointments. But as you were talking about, CareMore also decided to deploy a program to improve diabetes management, which afflicts some 30 million Americans. But that number, unfortunately, is expected to triple in the coming decades. And I'm wondering if you could describe some of those targeted interventions.
You know, what we do is not rocket science. And I think before I sort of really got to CareMore and kind of really got embedded in the model, I thought that there was going to be all of this proprietary IP. And, you know, there is some of that. But I think the most significant piece is managing chronic disease is a relational art. So we focus on building really strong, durable, engaged relationships with our patients so that they are in our care and they know that they're in our care and that they know that somebody is actually concerned about their overall well-being. And it's amazing what focusing on relationships can do. So, you know, it's old school medicine.
Right.
But as many of us know, old school medicine has gone out of fashion a lot of places. And, you know, part of our, I think, role is in promoting a system that really works and really showing people the art of the possible. I think one of the key enablers of the CareMore model is the fact that the chassis on which we're built is not a fee-for-service chassis.
Mm-hmm.
We are built on, you know, with a notion of full delegation of risk, meaning we get paid a per-member, per-month, you know, risk-adjusted payment for the care of our patients. And we are fully responsible for all of their healthcare expenditure. So because we have a high level of loyalty, our patients don't leave us. So we're not playing the game that a lot of insurance entities play, which is not being concerned about, you know, longitudinal healthcare costs. Our average member stays with us for 9 years. So we're investing. We're spending more money up front than we're often being paid, with the idea that long term, our patients will have fewer medical complications, a slower progression of disease, fewer acute episodes of illness. You know, the average acute episode of illness lands somebody in the hospital and costs $12,000 or $15,000. If you were to take that money and actually reinvest it in prevention, which is what we do, you get phenomenal outcomes. And that's how we're able to provide transportation to our members, because we know that that's one of the barriers to access to care. That's how we're able to provide post-discharge meals for patients who don't have food at home when they get discharged from the hospital. That's how we're able to deliver a togetherness program, which focuses on providing social interaction and engagement for our most socially isolated members. That's how we're able to provide a Nifty After 50 gym, which focuses on senior wellness and exercise. You know, those are expensive interventions, but they're far less expensive than sending a patient to the hospital for an ICU admission.
Well, Dr. Jane, obviously, the burning question was, so how come this isn't available to everybody? But before we get there, let me start with an earlier question that I wanted to ask your comment about the togetherness program. You know, we've been hearing a lot, and we had Dr. Charles Alessi from the National Health Service in England on the show recently, really zeroing in on this question of loneliness, the isolation and the loneliness that's faced by so many people, and just how bad it is for health outcomes, particularly among the elderly. And I know that this is something that you all have recognized, but it sounds like you've taken that to a higher level in terms of specifically targeting loneliness as a health issue. So tell us a little bit about that and what dementia prevention strategies are showing promise in your work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, loneliness is an epidemic in plain sight in American society. There's been a change in our family and social structure in this country such that seniors are living longer, but they're also living lonelier. And so we have patients whose only interaction with other people is oftentimes through the healthcare system or through, you know, retail consumption. And so one of the things that we've recognized is that lonelier seniors oftentimes take less good care of themselves. We talked about the burden of chronic disease. The way in which chronic disease is managed is through high levels of self-care, watching your diet, taking your medicines, going for a walk once in a while. And, you know, what we find is people who are not connected to other people, oftentimes the first thing that goes is their self-care. And so we believe that for the loneliest patients in our healthcare system, a weekly intervention, a phone call from somebody who cares about you can make all the difference in the world. It can be that spark of encouragement. It can be a nexus point for a connection to community resources that can really, really make a difference. And so we have what we believe is the world's largest and at this point oldest loneliness program. We call it the Togetherness Program because we want to destigmatize this condition. And we connect people with Togetherness connectors. We make weekly phone calls to them. For particularly socially isolated members, we send social work interns or other individuals into the home to try to pull people out of their homes and connect them with others. We encourage them to participate in group exercise activities at our senior gyms. We make sure that their medical needs are met and connect them with medical appointments. And what we're seeing from the early data, we just celebrated the first year anniversary of this program, is that these patients are healthier and they're participating in preventative healthcare measures more and they're participating in exercise more. We saw a 75% greater participation rate in a group exercise activity in an intervention group as compared with a control group because people were participating in this togetherness program. So really just an incredible opportunity, I think, for us to scale impact and make a dent in a problem of greater and greater importance in our society. You asked about dementia. Unfortunately, dementia is one of these areas of medicine and clinical care where we don't have a lot of good medicines or treatments. And there's a lot of great research underway in this area. And I think, we're really going to look to the pharmaceutical industry to come up with some solutions to this problem. But before those solutions get to market, we need to figure out ways to take better care of dementia patients. And one of the worst places you can take care of a dementia patient is in the hospital. Hospitals are disorienting. They cause episodes. When you take a demented patient, you put them in an unfamiliar setting, and it's literally a recipe for delirium, and delirium is a recipe for a downward spiral for a dementia patient. So a lot of what we do is teach families how to anticipate needs for dementia patients, how to proactively intervene when they have healthcare and medical problems, and what to expect. Ordinarily, there's this phenomenon of sundowning in many demented patients where they become a little bit delirious in the evening hours. That can be very scary for families. And so the first place that they'll take their family members is to the emergency room, which then can sometimes create this downward spiral of a hospitalization. But if they know what to expect, if they know how to redirect their family members, and if they know to call their doctor first before going to the emergency room, then oftentimes they can stay out of the hospital. And staying out of the hospital, they can avoid downward spiral, which I observed so many times when I was a more regularly practicing inpatient physician at the VA in Boston. So this is, I think one of the great opportunities we have is to, while we wait for these great pharmaceutical interventions to come to treat, the disease of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, helping families learn how to use the healthcare system for patients who do have cognitive impairment can be a huge opportunity to improve the quality of care and decrease healthcare costs.
Well, that is great. And I was thinking, as you were talking about isolation, one of our staff says isolation is the leprosy of modern times. So it's good to know that you're very focused in on that. We're speaking today with Dr. Sachin Jain, President and CEO of CareMore Health, an integrated health care system focused in on improving care coordination for Medicare and Medicaid patients, significantly improving outcomes. He was just named to Modern Healthcare's 50 Most Influential Physician Leaders. Well, I think we all read in the news, Dr. Jain, that Atul Gawande has been appointed the CEO of the newly formed Amazon Berkshire Hathaway JP Morgan organization. And I'm wondering, as you think about this broad charge that he has, improve efficiency, save money, better job for caring for patients, do you have any other advice that you'd pass along as he takes on this enormous challenge?
Absolutely. I think too many efforts to change healthcare in this country have ignored the American healthcare workforce. And I think that the most important thing we can do is to make sure that we have happy physicians and happy nurses, and that we support clinical models where we're restoring the joy of practice. It's become very trite and commonplace to say that we want to restore the joy in practice. We need to make being a physician or a nurse in America sexy again. It used to be 20, 25 years ago that this was considered the greatest profession of all. I think we really need to do that. And sometimes people say that, you know, we need to create a more patient-centered care to the exclusion of a physician-centered healthcare system. And I think the truth is that you need to be centered on both. You can't have a patient-centered healthcare system without taking care of the workforce that delivers the care. And I think there's been a devaluation of that and a dehumanization of the healthcare workforce. We tend to treat healthcare workers and clinicians like they are commodities. And we used words like provider to describe them, when in fact they're highly trained professionals with high values and a moral code. So the thing that makes me most excited about Atul taking that position, and he's just a giant in the field, is that he's probably one of the most sophisticated thinkers on healthcare. I know he gets this. And so I know that the solutions that he's going to be thinking about are going to be holistic and thinking about patients, physicians, system-wide stewardship, care teams. These are all topics that Atul has inspired the whole industry around. And I think that that's going to result in solutions that are inclusive, a more holistic view of the whole thing.
Well, Dr. Jane, I'm really excited to hear about your excitement about and focus on training both the current and the next generation of physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, and sounds like PAs and social workers and maybe community health workers, pharmacists, aides, and the whole group of people. But I'd be really interested to hear, since much of this kind of model is not something that people are trained to in depth. And you know, this is something that we've put a lot of focus on in our work around postgraduate training in particular, but also now with medical assistants. We do it with RNs in primary care, with nurse practitioners, physicians, and others to train people to clinical complexity, which you certainly have in abundance, but also train them to a evolving, high-performing model of care and just the idea of having the same care team caring for the patient as they're in the acute care setting, caring for them when they're back home. So maybe just talk with us a little bit about what kind of infrastructure you've built for that.
So, you know, I think that at the center of the infrastructure is something we're calling the CareMore Academy. But we just recruited our first vice president for the CareMore Academy, which is a gentleman from Connecticut named Bob Tedeschi. And Bob is, you know, what I would call a polymath. He's so skilled across so many different domains. He was a college athlete, so he really understands teams. He's a Pulitzer-nominated journalist for the New York Times, and so he's got the gift of personal articulation. He's a spouse of a nurse, a mother of a nurse, so he has a deep understanding of the healthcare system and the central role of compassion and the need to preserve that compassion for people who deliver care. And what we're really working on with him is designing programs that are around the culture of true team-based care for the sickest of the sick. It's the central task in building the healthcare system of the future is actually getting these elements right. And so I would say that's a very critical part of it. A second part of it is having a real focus on what the product is and product definition. For that reason, we recently appointed Dr. Vivek Garg, CareMore's Chief Product Officer. It's the first time we've had that role, but really recognizing the need for us to build scalable platforms and chassis onto which we can layer different components to serve different populations. CareMore's, kind of known for its historical model that you referenced, the care centers and the extensivists, but we're now live in Connecticut with a home-based primary care model. We have a 10-year history providing institutional care for nursing home and homebound patients that wraps around their kind of traditional healthcare delivery model. All healthcare is very local, and so the needs evolve and they change. Some parts remain the same, and some parts are different. And so for that reason, we're just getting much more rigorous about how we define our product, how we scale our product. And, you know, you asked this question before about why this model hasn't scaled in more places. I would say this is at the heart of it, is kind of, you know, getting really rigorous in the same way that, you know, Apple is rigorous about designing products. We in the healthcare delivery world have not been that rigorous about designing products. And that's why people like Bob and Vivek are going to be so critical. At the same time, you know, the foundation of all of this is world-class clinical care. And that's why, you know, we appointed Dr. Zubin Eapen, our chief medical officer last year. You know, he's, you know, one of these world-class cardiologists. He was an associate professor at Duke University, a renowned clinical investigator. And he sets the standard for the quality of clinical care in every single interaction. And, you know, that's what this takes. It takes, you know, the right culture, the right product definition, and, you know, the right clinical care to actually take care of the patients that we serve.
I was thinking, as you were talking about a world-class cardiologist, we just had Dr. Eric Topol on the show recently talking about tech's essential role in advancing personalized medicine. And I was thinking, over your 25-year journey, clearly the aggregation of data and the new technologies coming into play must have a profound influence on what you can achieve now. Talk to our listeners a little bit about actionable data and any particular digital application that you find that's been useful.
So I think data is going to enable the hyper-personalization and the hyper-customization of healthcare. One of my big frustrations in the healthcare system is that no matter who you are, the system treats you exactly the same. And it's very American in some ways to think that that's what it should look like, you know, equal care delivery for equal people. The problem is that all of us don't have equal needs. Some of us are sicker. Some of us are more complex. And so the system needs to adapt in real time to meet people's needs. And your average medical office visit does not look different today than it did, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And so, you know, we're on the bleeding edge of this, starting to think about how different types of data can be brought to bear on making these clinical encounters even more personalized. And so some of the types of things we're exploring are things like integrating the use of pharmacogenomics data by actually gene sequencing all of our patients to understand, you know, what kinds of drugs will work for our patients and what kinds of drugs will not work for our patients. That hyper-personalization is going to, you know, unlock lots of opportunities for us to improve the quality of care, reduce costs, and really make it so that we're not just practicing trial and error medicine. I think the average American thinks that our healthcare system is much more scientific and much more precise. I think I thought that before I went to medical school. And then you quickly realize that we're just beginning to scratch the surface on some of life's greatest mysteries. You know, 40, 50 years ago, we didn't even know the structure of DNA. And today we're you know, inventing custom treatments based on single base pair deletions in the genome. And so there's just, you know, a rapid evolution that's going to evolve, the underlying basis of which is just greater and greater amounts of information. But we need systems and processes to organize that information so that it's actionable for clinicians at the point of care. That's what's needed, and that's what I think we're most excited about.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Sachin Jain, President and CEO of CareMore Health, an integrated health system focused on improving care coordination and care for Medicare and Medicaid patients. You can learn more about their care model by going to CareMore.com or follow him on Twitter at SACJAI. Dr. Jain, thank you so much for your innovative work in transforming care delivery and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Really appreciate it.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Several Democrats in Congress have made pre-existing health conditions an issue in their fight against President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The issue concerns a court case filed by Texas and 19 other states arguing that the ACA individual mandate, that's the requirement that you have insurance, is unconstitutional and therefore the whole law must go. The Department of Justice has sided with the plaintiffs in the case but said it doesn't think the entire health care law should be scrapped. It said only two provisions would have to be eliminated if the case were successful. Provisions guaranteeing that those with pre-existing conditions won't be denied coverage or charged more based on health status. We don't know if this case, filed in a district court in Texas, will even make it to the Supreme Court, and if it does, it likely won't be until 2020. But several Democrats have made this a main talking point. A week before Kavanaugh's nomination, a TV ad from a Democratic group warned that the nominee could eliminate the ACA's pre-existing condition protections, a move that, quote, would take us back to a time when insurance companies could deny you coverage. Prior to the ACA's enactment, insurers could deny coverage based on health status, but only on the individual market, where those without employer-based plans or public coverage buy their own insurance. 7% of the population has individual market coverage. Under HIPAA, employer plans couldn't deny insurance to workers. But if a new employee had a gap in insurance coverage of more than 63 days, employer plans could exclude coverage for a particular pre-existing condition for a limited period, up to a year. Pregnancy couldn't be excluded, however. The ACA's pre-existing condition protections mainly affect the individual market, but the law also gave peace of mind to those with employer coverage or those who might want to start their own business and therefore need to get insurance on the individual market. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 5 Americans will suffer a diagnosable mental health condition in a given year, and most often don't seek treatment. For those with serious mental health conditions, the consequences can be devastating. Hospitalizations, loss of job or home, or even early death. Seeing a rise in mobile apps aimed at behavioral health entering the marketplace, University of Washington researcher Dror Ben Zev thought a comparative effective analysis study would be a good idea.
My team and I conducted a 3-year comparative effectiveness trial, having a head-to-head comparison between a mobile health intervention for people with serious mental illness called FOCUS, and a more traditional clinic-based group intervention called WRAP, or Wellness Recovery Action Planning. So it's conducted at a clinic setting. So the study really gets at some of the core differences between mobile health and clinic-based care. Is there something about the mobile health approach that would make it more accessible or less accessible?
More than 90% of the mobile app group engaged in the online program, which was a series of text messages offering coping strategies and self-monitoring of symptoms, along with weekly call-ins with a behavioral health clinician. Both groups of patients saw roughly equal results from their completed treatment, but the mobile group was more likely to engage in therapy.
The second thing we wanted to see is, after people complete care, what are their subjective ratings of their experience in treatment? Are they satisfied with both interventions? And probably the most important piece of the study are the clinical outcomes. So we measure to see whether involvement in both interventions for a 12-week period, would that create some sort of difference in psychiatric symptom severity, and 90% of the individuals who were randomized into the mobile health arm actually went on to meet a mobile health specialist who used the intervention app that's assigned to them at least once. Whereas in the clinic-based arm, we saw that only 58% of the participants assigned to that clinic-based intervention ever made it in for a single session.
Ben Zev says this suggests that mobile therapies may provide a useful tool for clinicians having trouble getting those with serious mental health issues to engage with the clinical interventions.
The group dynamics, the fact that there's a sense of shared experience, that on its own is quite potent for people, right? And so we know that the very existence of a group can be quite helpful. But for others, the interaction is anxiety provoking. When it comes to the clinical outcomes, in both intervention arms, people improved both in terms of reduction in their symptoms and the distress associated with symptoms and improvements in their recovery.
The results of this study were published in the Journal of Psychiatric Services, a targeted mobile app aimed at facilitating access to clinical care for those experiencing serious mental illness symptoms, proving equally effective in managing the condition, improving access to intervention for behavioral health needs. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.